Welcome back to McClanahan Academy's United States History 1865 to the present. We're at presentation 2, Occupation, Corruption, and the End of Reconstruction. Now, what I'm going to cover in this particular presentation essentially is military reconstruction through the Grant administration. One thing I'm not going to cover in this presentation is reconstruction for African Americans. I'm going to cover that particular topic in another unit in the class. I mentioned that in the last presentation. But I'm going to do that closer to the end of the course with civil rights. I'll get into some of the things that happened during Reconstruction, some of the developments during that time period, and looking at it in the long perspective rather than just this very short period as I'm talking about the Grant administration and the end of Reconstruction in that way. Now, when I say the end of Reconstruction, of course, as I mentioned before, Reconstruction can carry through into the 21st century. But this is the official end of Reconstruction as historians like to designate it, 1877. We know that that's not particularly the case in some of the areas, and even when we talk about things like the New South and the Gilded Age and the West, all that's going to be part of Reconstruction, ultimately. But in terms of a static end date, it's often cited as 1877 as the end of Reconstruction. Then you have the Gilded Age, and you have these other things that are supposedly separate, but in reality still part of it. However, again, I'm going to focus on some of these thematic issues and other presentations in the course. So don't think that you're not going to get this stuff. You are. But what I want to focus on here is the political side of it, essentially, and what's happening from the top down. We'll talk a little bit about some of the corruption in the Grant administration. This is a survey course. We're not going to get into great detail in anything, but just to give you, to whet your appetite, give you an idea as to what's going on in the Grant administration. And we'll talk about, in the Gilded Age presentation, some of the things that the United States government was doing to grease the wheels of business, for example. We'll talk about in the New South some of the things that are happening there with Reconstruction in the South and being punished with poverty. Some of these things that I've already addressed, but I'm going to go into a little more detail. The same thing with Reconstruction for African Americans and what that was like for them, and then, of course, moving forward into the 20th century and into the middle of the 20th century. So let's get started here. So in terms of chronology, 1865, the 13th Amendment is ratified. We talked about that a little bit in the last presentation, but we are gonna get into constitutional reconstruction in this particular presentation, so we'll talk about it again. We've got the Supreme, it's a Supreme Court, sort of a Supreme Court case, Ex parte Milligan. It's not actually before the court itself, but one of the judges was riding the circuit, is what it's called. The First Reconstruction Act, 1867, the Tenure of Office Act, and Command of the Army Act, both are important for the ultimate impeachment of Andrew Johnson, which takes place in 1868. The Omnibus Act of 1868 is important for how Johnson's plan for Reconstruction is blocked and how Congress's plan is put into effect. We get the 1868, the 14th Amendment ratified, and I put that in quotations because I'll talk about how that may not have been the case. U.S. Grant is elected president in 1868. 1869, you get the Gould-Fisk scandal in Black Friday. 1870, the 15th Amendment is ratified. 1872, the Credit Mobilier scandal. 1872, Grant wins re-election. And then 1873, the Crime of 73. These are all part of the scandals of the Grant administration. 1876, Rutherford B. Hayes is elected president. In 1877, you get the Compromise of 1877, which theoretically ends Reconstruction. So I'll talk about all these things. And of course, there's other things going on here. Again, in a survey course, I'm not going to touch on all the particular issues happening in Reconstruction. We've got a lot of other things to talk about in 36 lectures. But these are some of the highlights, of this particular time period. So, we talked about the Radical Republicans in the last presentation, and people like Thad Stevens, who's pictured here, people like Charles Sumner, people like Benjamin Wade, and who they were. But their agenda was pretty clear when you go into this military or congressional reconstruction. First, as they said, it was a righteous cause to forge a new union. Remember in the last presentation, I talked about this, how we have a new union, it's the process of recreating America, not resuming America or reconstructing America. It's creating a new America, and they were open about it. They would use phrases like the process was to avenge the Union men who died in the war, to punish the South, to remake the South. It's one party, one branch control of the central government. And it's more accurately the tyranny of the Republican Party. There was no blocking the Republican Party. The executive branch couldn't do it. The judicial branch was not very receptive to it, and then they didn't do it. And of course, as per the prerogative of the Congress and the Constitution, they take the ability for the judicial branch to block them away. So essentially what we have is a rump Congress. And what do I mean by that? Well, during the English Civil War, you had a parliament that was essentially in charge of England during what's called the Protectorate. And that parliament, which was led by a group known as the Roundheads, who were much more radical Puritans, dominated the government. And in this particular case, you have radical Republicans dominating the government. And for years, this was known, and it wasn't necessarily a good thing. Even if for people who would be sympathetic to their agenda, they didn't like the idea of a government unchecked. But now, this is seen as a tragic era. This is seen as something, or an unfinished revolution. The tragic era was Claude Bowers, who said this was a terrible time. But someone like Eric Foner, who says this is an unfinished revolution. And his new book is essentially going to point this out. This is recreating America. So I think that because of the political slant and way politics in America are going now, it's okay to support this kind of righteous cause to forge a new union. And it's seen as a missed opportunity rather than a tragic era where Americans are being abused and government is being trampled and this is all being done by the bayonet. That's okay to people now, because the idea is on the left and the right, the South deserved to be punished. So we're going to talk about how all this worked out. Now, the first Reconstruction Act of 1867 was passed by Congress, and the idea was to implement what's known as military or congressional reconstruction. All the southern states except Tennessee were removed from the Union. I put that word removed in quotations for a reason. I'll talk about that. The remaining 10 states were divided into 5 military districts subject to martial law. States were then forced to draw up new constitutions and ratify the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. So the question is, was this legal? Well, that's a big question. Number one, can the United States Congress remove a state from the Union? We just fought a war for 4 years that said states can't leave the Union. But now the Congress is saying, well, we can remove you from the Union. You're not a state any longer. So does the Congress have a power to invalidate a state? Well, according to the Constitution, no. Only the people of the state can do that. And in this particular case, the Congress is saying they are removing. Now, you can make the argument possibly that because Congress can admit new states, it can boot states out of the Union. And this is exactly the argument that the Supreme Court is going to make in 1869 with the very famous Supreme Court case, Texas v. White, which I talk about in more detail in both my class on American constitutions and my class on Reconstruction, which is an entire 20-lecture course on Reconstruction. But this is a big question. Now, I would make the point that, they just fought a war to do it, and so now you're saying you can do it, so is secession actually legal? I mean, is secession actually legal as long as the Congress does it? And essentially, that's what the Supreme Court says in 1869. The other question here is, can states which aren't states ratify an amendment? We know the Constitution is clear on this in Article 5. The states have to ratify the amendments, or conventions of the people of the states and the states themselves have to ratify amendments. So can a state that's not a state, you're saying these states are not states any longer, they're essentially territories or provinces. This is what people like Stevens or Sumner would say. So can a state that's not a state ratify an amendment? Well, clearly not. But yet these states, which aren't states, are required now to ratify an amendment. It's this legal mumbo jumbo that creates all kinds of problems. Now, the whole point of all of this, at the end of the day, was for one thing, black suffrage. What do I mean by that? The Republican Party understood that if they don't get this amendment ratified, that they will not win elections in the South because they have the freedmen vote locked up. They know that former slaves are going to vote en masse for the Republican Party. It's the party of Lincoln. It's the party that ended slavery. They're going to do that. However, they're not the majority in most of the states. So you're going to have to disfranchise people to ensure that Black Southerners are now the majority, and that's exactly what the 14th Amendment did. It disfranchised large swaths of the Southern population. In the process, you create black majorities in these states, which means that Republicans now, because there are also white Republicans in the South by this point, Republicans are going to win elections, and the Democrats are not going to win. This creates a very tense situation in these Southern states, as I'll talk about as we move forward. It's almost as if they didn't see, they were too blind to see exactly what they were going to do, and you just had a war, you just had a bunch of people, millions of people, who were engaged in a physical conflict, and you're asking these people now to just be pacifists and not try to defend what they think they should have. On the other hand, you're asking some people that have now been given things they never had before. Citizenship, right to own property, at least legally own property. They could own property before in other ways, but now legally own property. In many cases, the right to vote, the right to sue in court. You're asking these people to not defend what they have now. So you're creating two armed camps, and the general government was actually arming the one side against the other. This is going to create a very messy situation, which is why Reconstruction gets very nasty. Now, here are the 1867 military districts. So you can see there are five districts. You have the District 1, which was just Virginia. And then you have District 2, which is the Carolinas. District 3, which is Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. District 4 is Arkansas, Mississippi. And District 5 is Texas and Louisiana. The date is the date that they are readmitted to the Union. So you can see most of the states were readmitted between 1868 and 1870. Now, this is not entirely the case because they say they're readmitted to the Union because this is when they ratified the 14th Amendment. But Georgia, for example, actually came back in, that was booted out and came back in again. The other thing about this is that what you often see this in Atlas and other things, where they say that the state, for example, Georgia, I've seen this several times. Georgia became a state in 1776, and it became a state again in 1870. Georgia never stopped being a state. This general government cannot say that this is not a state. But what you're looking at here when it says date of readmission to the Union, well, where were they? Well, according to the general government, these are military provinces. These are territories now. But that's not the case. Only the people can decide that, the people of the states, not the general government. So this is misleading. These states never ceased being states. It's just the general government was illegally treating them that way, that they were not states. So this is a major constitutional question that's never really dealt with. Can the general government do this? Does it have the power to boot a state out of the Union or say it's not a state? Now, Johnson, in conservative fashion, correctly vetoes the bill. He says this is unconstitutional. He was right. You can't do this, but, of course, the Congress, now with a supermajority after the 1866 congressional election, overrides the veto and forces him to send 20,000 troops south to enforce the law. Many of these troops are black. And so that was done on purpose. The idea was to arm the African-American population in the South and ensure that Southerners, white Southerners, could not rise up against this Reconstruction government. Registered black voters now outnumbered registered white voters. There were 627,000 registered white voters, some of whom were Republican, and 703,000 registered black voters, almost all of whom were Republican. So the idea was to have perpetual Republican control of the South. The million voters in the South, there were very few Democrats that were able. Now, I should say very few. Less than half of the voters were Democrats. So the Republicans are going to win every election. This was by design. This is exactly what they wanted to do. And U.S. Grant would not have won election, I should say, in 1868 without this situation. And he knew it. The Republicans knew it. Now, Omnibus Act of 1868, military reconstruction required the use of the army to maintain Republican control of the South, and three states were under military control until 1876 through 77. Seven former Confederate states were allowed back in the Union after following the provisions of the First Reconstruction Act. That's what I showed you on the map. This is due to the presence of the military and the disfranchisement of white voters. Now, Georgia would place back under military reconstruction after it ignored provisions of the 14th Amendment and removed blacks from the state legislature. This is known as reoccupation to white Georgians. They were allowed back in 1868. They were booted out and then brought back in 1870. But between 1870 and 1877, we'll talk about this in a minute. You have something called the redeeming process, the Bourbon Redemption. This is when the states are going to go back under Democrat control. It takes some time, but it does happen. And that's the battle that you're going to see between these two camps, these two armed camps in the South. Now, Republicans, of course, wanted to get rid of Johnson. He was vetoing their legislation. He was a roadblock. Though he was easily overcome by a supermajority in Congress, it's still they wanted somebody in office in the executive branch that would do their bidding. And so they passed two laws in 1867. One is the Tenure of Office Act. The other is the Command of the Army Act, designed to trap Johnson and make him break the law. It was clear this is what would happen. Johnson was going to violate one or the other. He was going to either remove a cabinet official, which was the Tenure of Office Act. What the Congress said is you cannot remove cabinet officials without congressional approval. Well, this had never been the case. Now, there was some argument about this in the first Congress. Should the Congress, if they can have advice and consent on appointing members of the cabinet, should they also have advice and consent on removing members? And the first Congress decided that that wasn't necessary, that that would have not been in line with the Constitution. So this was the first time that Congress actually pulled this off. Now, the command of the army also said that you cannot remove the general of the army without congressional approval. Now, Andrew Johnson is commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy when called into actual service of the United States. And if you have a permanent army, they're always in actual service of the United States. So he, according to the Constitution, is the one that can determine who is the main general of the army. But Congress is saying, no, not anymore. You have to have our approval to do this. So Johnson was going to break the law one way or the other. And the question is, were they constitutional? Absolutely not. In fact, as I'll mention in a little bit, the Tenure of Office Act is later declared unconstitutional. But that's the law that Johnson breaks. He breaks it by firing Edwin Stanton. Edwin Stanton was the Secretary of War. There's a fantastic book about Edwin Stanton, very, very critical of Mr. Stanton, by William Marvel. And William Marvel has written a number of revisionist histories of the war, which are extremely critical of Abraham Lincoln. He's not pro-South. In fact, he's critical of the South as well. But he wrote it's breathing fire, this highly critical book of Edwin Stanton. And rightly so. Edwin Stanton is one of the scoundrels of the 1860s. Edwin Stanton was an opportunist. He was vicious. He abused military powers during the war and after the war. In fact, he replaced Southern with Northern ministers and Southern churches. Now, I've looked high and low in the Constitution to find the authority to do this. It's not there, but he was doing it anyways. And he was a known Republican spy in the cabinet. He would go back from cabinet meetings and rat out Johnson to the radical Republicans. And so Johnson gets rid of him. Well, this violates the Tenure of Office Act. So Andrew Johnson is then impeached by the House of Representatives. Andrew Johnson becomes the first president impeached by the U.S. House. He's not the only president to be impeached. The other, of course, would be Bill Clinton. But Andrew Johnson becomes the first to have this exercised against him. Now, when that happens, the president then goes to trial in the Senate, and the Supreme Court presides over the trial. And the Supreme Court at this time, the Chief Justice was Salmon P. Chase. Salmon P. Chase had been in the Lincoln cabinet, though he was a little more independent-minded. However, Chase also had presidential aspirations, and he was a bit concerned about the effect that a political witch hunt, a political impeachment, would have on future presidents. Chase actually wanted to be president himself. He was moving in that direction even by 1868, and it just didn't work out for him. In fact, I'll talk about that in a minute when we get to some of the things that were going on in the Chase court. But he presides over the trial, and the prosecution argues, in fact, the lead prosecutor was John Bingham, who wrote the 14th Amendment. Bingham was a radically partisan Republican. And he argued that Johnson broke the law and acted in a manner unbefitting of the president, in part for just vetoing legislation. How dare that guy do his job and veto our legislation? Well, Johnson's almost convicted. He fails by one vote. He's acquitted by one vote. 35 senators vote for removal of office, only 19 vote against, and 7 Republicans were in that 19. They vote against removing him from office. And the reason being is because they understood what would happen with impeachment. If they voted to get rid of Johnson, virtually every president would be subject to some type of political impeachment in the future. This was going to be used almost like the Greeks used ostracism if they did it this way. Now, if Johnson had clearly and unequivocally broken the law in a way that was not a murky constitutional question, well, that's another issue. But this was a murky constitutional question. But regardless, Johnson has a lame duck presidency until he leaves office. Now, what's interesting is that in 1976, in the case of Myers v. United States, the Supreme Court said that the Tenure of Office Act was unconstitutional. It clearly is. These laws were clearly unconstitutional. And so this was simply, if you look at, there's a lot of parallels between the Johnson impeachment and what the Democrats in 2018 and 17 and 19 have been trying to do to Donald Trump. This was a political witch hunt to try to get rid of a sitting president. It was a soft coup, is what they were trying to do here. And the Supreme Court knocked him down, or I should say the Senate knocked him down with the Supreme Court presiding over the trial. Now, as I said, this is also a period of constitutional reconstruction. So we've got the 13th, the 14th, and 15th Amendment. They're often known as the Civil War Amendments. They're added to the Constitution between 1865 and 1870. And so the Congress admits that it doesn't have the power to do all of these things without an amendment. One of the things the Congress is going to do is going to reduce the power of the Supreme Court, which is not unconstitutional but highly irregular. They're going to remove some of the oversight processes for the court. This was actually at the insistence of Salmon P. Chase. Salmon P. Chase also wanted to reduce the number of Supreme Court justices because he thought he had a chance to become president and then he could appoint some of these other justices. But this happens in 1866, and I'm going to explain what happens and why the Congress does this stuff. But 1865, the Congress will pass through the 13th Amendment, and then that goes to the states for ratification, and it's ratified in 1865, thus admitting that the Congress never had the power to legislate for slavery in one way or another in the states of the United States. This does not handle the territory question, but they admit that they couldn't have abolished slavery in the South, which Southerners knew well, which is why the Corwin or Lincoln Amendment would have been irrelevant. And Southerners mentioned that. I said, look, you don't have any power to abolish slavery in the South. That's not what we're arguing about here. We're worried about the territories and what's going to happen there. But Congress abolishes slavery unless you are a prisoner. And then you can be made a slave. And this is actually a big case not long ago. There were some people that were talking about abolishing the 13th Amendment because of that particular provision of it. 1866, Congress, at the insistence of Chase, reduces the number of Supreme Court justices from 10 to 7. It was increased back to 9 in 1869 after the election of Republican U.S. Grant. In 1870, you get the 15th Amendment, which allows all men, regardless of race, the privilege of voting. This was an interesting shift. And the arguments that were made against the 15th Amendment are rather interesting, in fact. If you read it, I mean, people go back and read it. This is all about race. Well, the arguments that were made were not necessarily all about race. It was about the Congress infringing on the ability of the states to control elections. This had always been up to the states. It had never been up to the Congress before, but now it is. And that was one of the arguments that was made. Well, I mean, if the Congress can do this, if we can say who can, I mean, look, before it was just you had to be 25. They said nothing about voting, who could vote or who couldn't vote. If you can do this now, if you take this away from the states, then it's a slippery slope to getting other things. And eventually that happens, right? We get more amendments that change things. And so the states have more and more restrictions on how they can say who can vote and who can't vote. Essentially, we've federalized or nationalized elections. It's something that the founding generation and the framers of the Constitution were against. The states had complete control over this. Now, why did the Congress pull some of the court jurisdiction? Because of this particular decision, the Ex parte Milligan decision in 1866. It was a split decision, 2-1 decision. But what happened here is Salmon P. Chase, who was riding the circuit, declared that martial law and military courts were illegal so long as civil courts were in operation. So essentially what he's done is invalidated what would become the military reconstruction. He's invalidated it before it even happens. So when they remove jurisdiction over this and then the Congress passes the first Reconstruction Act, they do it anyways, right? There were civil courts open in the South. But according to Congress, that doesn't matter anymore, even if the Supreme Court said this is unconstitutional. So this is why they did this. This is why they removed court jurisdiction over this, because now they can just operate this with impunity. They can just say, all right, we're going to do whatever we want. Now, what about that pesky 14th Amendment? Well, in 1868, the 14th Amendment is ratified. But remember, former Confederate states were required to ratify the amendment to reenter the Union. Now, how does that work? How can a state that's not a state ratify an amendment? Well, we know it can't. This gave former slave citizenship of the United States, but not the individual states. You could still be a citizen of the United States, but not the state in which you reside. It struck down the Black Codes, which, interestingly enough, were at this point still in some ways effect in places like Ohio and Illinois and Indiana. It prohibited former high-ranking Confederate officials from holding office or voting. The question is, was it ever legally ratified? And even states at the time recognized that it was not ratified. The point of this thing was to enforce the Civil Rights Act to make that where black Southerners could own property and sue in court. That was the whole point of the 14th Amendment. Now, we've run with this in so many other directions. In my American Constitutions course, I get into that. It's called incorporation. We'll talk about it a little bit later in this particular course. We'll go over a couple instances of that. Not in much detail. But that's the idea of incorporation, that somehow the 14th Amendment made it to where the Bill of Rights applied to the states. Well, even during the discussion of the amendment, there were some that said this might be the case, but they were struck down, and that was never the original intent. In fact, if it was, or if the 14th Amendment, for example, was a legal block to segregation, public schools in Washington, D.C. remained segregated. No one thought this was the case. And in fact, the Supreme Court explicitly said as much in the very famous slaughterhouse cases, which took place in Louisiana not long after this, where the court said, nah, I mean, this thing doesn't incorporate the Bill of Rights to the states. It just doesn't do that. Now, 28 states were needed for ratification, and two states rescinded their ratification, Ohio and New Jersey, when they figured out that this thing was going to be rammed through without any real legal precedent. And so this left the total at 26, though technically 16 states of 37 did not legally ratify the document, because you had the former Confederate states plus Ohio and New Jersey. So really only 10 ratified the document. Only 10 states ratified this document when the amendment was promulgated. But Secretary of State William H. Seward was forced to promulgate it, regardless of the decision of New Jersey and Ohio. And so this is a congressional abuse of power. Only 10 states really ratified it. I mean, a state that's not a state can't ratify it. It's a state under duress ratifying an amendment. But regardless, even if you say that those southern states did ratify it, still they only had 26, because Ohio and New Jersey said, we don't ratify this thing anymore. We rescind our ratification. Well, the Congress says, well, you can't do that. Once you ratify it, it's ratified. Is that true? You can't back out once you say, hey, look, we don't really want this thing anymore? I mean, this is how ridiculous the Republicans are. Now, 1868 is a presidential election year, and U.S. Grant is the Republican nominee for president. He's a hero of the war for the North. This is the guy that defeated Lee. And the North will engage in what's known as the Bloody Shirt Campaign. They grab a shirt that was worn by a Union soldier. Maybe it has blood on it. Maybe they add some blood to it. Whatever the case may be, they stick it on a stick and they wave it around. And they say, if you vote for the Democrats, you're voting for the guy that shot this guy and killed this guy. If you vote for the Republicans, you're voting for the guy that wore this shirt. And this is very effective. I remember back in 2004, the Republicans essentially did the same thing when George W. Bush was running against John Kerry. It's a Bloody Shirt Campaign. You vote for the Democrats, you're voting for the terrorists. You vote for George W. Bush, you're voting for the soldiers. It's just a Bloody Shirt Campaign. No different. His opponent in 1868 was Horatio Seymour of New York, the former governor of New York, the war governor of New York. He was criticized as being a man who was soft on Reconstruction, who had not really favored the war. I mean, Seymour was a little, you know, wishy-washy on the war. I mean, he didn't necessarily come out and say he was completely against it, but he was not, he wasn't a fan of Lincoln. He wasn't a fan of the Republican Party during the war. And so, that's used against him. Now, Seymour should have won this election. Grant only wins because of the sizable Union veteran vote and the black vote in the South. It's the only reason U.S. Grant wins. In fact, there's probably a tremendous amount of voter fraud in this particular election. Just like there was voter fraud in the 1864 election. So the Union Army vote, the Grand Army of the Republic now, which has become essentially a political, what we would call political action committee today, but it's become a slush fund for the Republican Party as people donate to the Grand Army of the Republic. It just donates onto the Republican Party. It's the reason why Horatio Seymour loses the election. And you can see it's really close. Grant wins by about 300,000 votes. You take away that huge numeric advantage in the South, and the situation is drastically different. Now, you can see that Grant wins handily in the Electoral College, which is all that matters. But he does not necessarily do as much to say that this is a landslide victory. I mean, and Grant probably would have lost this election had it not been for the Union veteran vote and the black vote in the South. So Grant becomes the 18th president of the United States. He serves two terms, 1869 to 1877. He is the hero of Appomattox. He won the war for the Union. Grant was a Democrat. He's from Ohio, and Ohio was one of the most racist states in the United States. He wasn't. His family owned slaves. Grant even owned slaves himself at one point. He was the youngest president in history to this point. But he really wasn't acclimated to politics. He preferred his liquor and his cigars. There's a lot of different views on Grant. Was he just kind of a helpless victim with a capital V, where everything happened to Grant and he couldn't help himself? Or was Grant behind the scandals? Depends on who you read. If you read Ron Chernow, he would portray Grant as a tragic individual who was just dragged through the mud. But if you read someone like Phil Lee, which I think is more convincing, Grant had his fingerprints all over this stuff. Grant's greatest scandal was Reconstruction. So we're going to talk about corruption and scandal at the state and federal level. We'll look at the end of Reconstruction and home rule for the South. And we'll talk about the Indian Wars in the presentation on the West, which is coming up in a little bit. So first, the scandals. 1869, you get the Gould-Fisk scandal, which leads to something known as Black Friday. The price of gold plunges at this point because Grant had essentially, and Jay Gould supposedly had some insider information from Grant, and then but essentially what happens is Gould tries to corner the gold market. It fails, and gold prices plunge, and the stock market crashes. And this leads to what's known as Black Friday, which is a major economic downturn in the United States. In 1872, you get the Credit Mobilier scandal. This was a securities company designed to help build the Transcontinental Railroad. And the Transcontinental Railroad, which we'll talk about when we get to the West, is one of the major government internal improvement projects. Well, there's a lot of corruption with this. And Credit Mobilier is behind it all. And they were bribing members of Congress, including the Vice President of the United States, Schuyler Colfax, excuse me. And this is all discovered, and Colfax is ousted in disgrace. So there's a lot of people implicated in Congress because of this Credit Mobilier scandal. It is graft at its worst, but it's what the Republicans were known for. Corruption, graft, money wasting. I mean, this is the Republican Party of the 1860s and 70s. And then, of course, you get the crime of 73 and the Coinage Act of 1873, which leads to the panic of 1873, an economic downturn again. What happens is the United States will go on the gold standard. They demonetize silver, which causes deflation. And so you have farmers who are really hurt by this, and people that were debtors But Grant decided, and the Congress decided, that the gold standard was better for the United States. And so that's what we get here in 1873. But also Reconstruction in general. Grant, I mean, is terrible on Reconstruction in general. I mean, this is one of the major scandals of his administration. Now, 1872 rolls around, and Grant is going to run for re-election, and he's opposed by Horace Greeley. Now, Horace Greeley was not a Democrat. Horace Greeley was a Republican. Horace Greeley was a liberal Republican. Horace Greeley was one of the most ardent lefties, what you would call a lefty, in the period leading up to the war. But by 1872, Horace Greeley had a somewhat of a change of heart. He had actually helped pay to get Jefferson Davis out of prison. He thought that Reconstruction was going too far, that it was bad for business, that they just needed to get back to the Union and put the war behind them and solve all this problem because it was creating a bad business climate and a bad image for the United States. So we need to get this Reconstruction thing over with, get the troops out of the South, get everything back to normal. That was Horace Greeley. And Grant and the radicals sought to retain control because Greeley would not have necessarily favored their policies. Well, Greeley loses, and after he loses, he actually suffers a stroke, and so he's incapacitated, but the Electoral College still has not met to vote yet, and there were votes for Horace Greeley. He dies before the Electoral College meets, and people still vote for Horace Greeley. That's how much they didn't want Grant. So if you look at this map and you see that there are still Electoral College votes for Horace Greeley in the red, three electoral college delegates from Georgia voted for Horace Greeley even though he's dead. So a dead guy is better than U.S. Grant. I mean, how funny is that? Now, this means that that Reconstruction will continue, and you have two individuals in the South, or two groups of people in the South, that are well known as being a real problem. One is the carpetbagger. A carpetbagger like Grant here on the back of the South is a Northerner who settled in the South after the war looking for political gain and economic profit. And a lot of these carpetbaggers were Union Army veterans. Several of them settled in places like Mississippi and the Carolinas. So the carpetbagger was not a native Southerner. He was coming down to the South to ensure that the confiscated property and other things he could get these homes, he could get this land for very little money, and he was going to make a killing. And this, look, even Harriet Beecher Stowe's son did this, right? All kinds of people did this. And they were horrible to Southerners. They were seen as lower than low. But the lowest of all were the scalawags. Scalawags were Southerners who supported the Republican Party in Reconstruction after the war. The most famous scalawag, or infamous scalawag, if you're taking the Southern position, was James Longstreet, a former general in the Confederate Army. In fact, Lee's right-hand man for the last couple of years of the war. But James Longstreet, when the war is over, becomes a Republican. In fact, it's James Longstreet that marches out in 1872, where he goes out and stops a riot in New Orleans using the police there. And this is there was a monument, it's called the Liberty Monument, which was the only monument that was ever constructed in the South that overtly said that this is about race. All the other ones were about soldiers and dead heroes, but not that one. And so that one's been taken down to New Orleans. But Longstreet was the man who was there. Now, he was good friends with Grant, which is why he was involved in this process. Longstreet thought, well, I can work within the Republican Party and try to control Reconstruction, or I can work from without. And he thought working from within was better. But this is why Longstreet was vilified after the war, for a long time after the war. Now, at the state level, you had tremendous corruption. Scalawags dominated the Reconstruction governments of Alabama and South Carolina. They were prominent scalawags in Mississippi and Louisiana, and they were seen as lower than carpetbaggers. In fact, the governor of Mississippi, the governor of Louisiana, these people were seen as highly problematic. Carpetbaggers were elected to the United States Congress in various Southern states. Many supported the economic diversification of the South and public school systems, particularly for former slaves. But again, there's no money coming from the federal government, so the states have to come up with this, which was very difficult to do. All Reconstruction governments were accused of excessive spending, corruption, and voter suppression. for white Southerners. The state debt of Alabama tripled. Florida property values decreased 45%. This is where Harriet Beecher Stowe's son picked up a plantation, then complained about black workers, saying they were lazy, writing back to his mother. The state debt of Georgia almost tripled in one four-year stretch during Reconstruction. Property taxes skyrocketed in both North and South Carolina. Louisiana state debt increased over fivefold with very little to show for it. This was the state corruption, and it was really bad. And the Republicans were controlling this, of course. Many of these Republicans were African Americans, and so this added a racial element to it. And this is why people will say, well, you can't criticize these governments because there's African Americans in them. But, I mean, when you look at the evidence, these governments were free spending, freewheeling, and not doing a very good job. That's not a racial argument. It's looking at the evidence and saying these things probably aren't, these state governments aren't being run very well by the Republican Party. So between 1870 and 1877, you get what's called the Bourbon Redemption. Southern Democrats will take control of state governments. This is resistance to military reconstruction. You have people like George Houston of Alabama, pictured at left, and James Smith, the governor of Georgia from Columbus, Georgia. What this means, these people don't like, don't sit around and drink bourbon all day, but this is a reference to the Bourbon Redemption of France, where the Bourbons, who are the royal family, come back into power following Napoleon, and essentially this is what's being said about here in the South. The Democrats take control of state governments, and they start booting out the Republicans. Now, as you can see, you've got the parentheses on this particular map. This is the date of reestablishment of conservative Democratic Party control. You can see on this map that Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina are still hanging around between 76 and 77. And Florida and Louisiana are going to be important in this process. Because in 1876, you have a presidential election. Samuel Tilden is a Democrat nominee for president. He runs on an anti-Reconstruction platform, and the South believes that they actually have a shot to win the election. And they were right. Except it's going to be stolen from them, it's thought. The Republicans nominate Rutherford B. Hayes of Ohio. He was a war hero. And what happens is you get a disputed election. There are two sets of returns for South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana. Three states still under military reconstruction. Tilden had already won the popular vote, but Hayes wins in the Electoral College with the disputed returns. So is this a stolen election? We know there was some voter fraud in this election as well. But we also know that Hayes is going to get the nod by one vote. Look at the Electoral College. 185, which was what was required to win, to 184. But Tilden actually wins by 300,000 votes in the popular vote. If South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana go for Tilden, he wins the election. The real catch, though, was Colorado. And this gets into what's known as the Compromise of 1877. Hayes would be elected president without Southern resistance under the following conditions. Federal troops are pulled out of the South. There was one Southern Democrat sent to the cabinet. That would be David Key of Tennessee as Postmaster General. And there would be some support for Southern industrialization and a Southern Transcontinental Railroad. One and two were accomplished, but three and four never happened, though Northern money poured into parts of the South and J.P. Morgan helped finance the Southern Railway. There's a reason for this, because they're trying to knock down Southern industrial recovery. Now, Hayes had already, though, suggested an end to Reconstruction during the campaign, so there's not much of a compromise here. In fact, the real kicker in all of this was the admission of Colorado as a state, which helped swing this vote in favor of the Republicans. The Democrats could have blocked that. Colorado was admitted just before the election. If Colorado doesn't come in, Tilden wins the election, and you have a Democrat in the executive office. But this was a big deal because there was some talk about secession again and a war if there wasn't some concession and Reconstruction didn't end in the South, and that's going to happen. So Hayes becomes the 19th president of the United States. He removes the federal troops and ends Reconstruction, at least military Reconstruction. He serves one term. And we'll talk about some of the economic issues and Indian wars in later presentations. But this was a big deal. It ended the military phase of Reconstruction, though the process of Reconstruction would be ongoing, as we'll talk about throughout the course. I'll reference back to Reconstruction at times when it's necessary. So that's it for Presentation 2. I will see you next time for Presentation 3.